Our second reading is from 2 Timothy 4. For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time for my departure is near. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. At my first offense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them. But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed, and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To God be glory forever and ever. Amen. This is the word of the Lord. How many of you have seen the 2007 movie, The Bucket List? Anybody? Okay, some of you. So this movie starred Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman. They meet in the hospital where both of them have received bad news that the time is short, and at first they clash with one another, but eventually they become good friends. They form a bond as they begin a series of adventures doing some things that they had on their bucket lists. So that movie plays with this idea of the bucket list, a list of projects or goals that would somehow haunt you if you didn't get to accomplish them before your life ends. And so, in light of that movie and in light of our reading today, I want you thinking today a little bit about what you might regret at the end of your life if you didn't get it done. Now, the tricky thing about bucket lists is that they presume we have plenty of time, or at least some time, enough time. And that isn't always how it happens. That's not always how life draws to a close. Often we don't get that time to make amends or mark things off of a list. So a bucket list, it's good. I'm all for it if you have time. But really what I want to talk about today is something even better. Better yet is if we can summon our best energy right now, beginning today, to lead the kind of life that will result in deep peace and real contentment when we approach the end of life as we know it. I'm not in love with this sermon title, How to Live Without Regrets. Maybe it's not a very accurate one, because I already have a few regrets. How about you? At age 14, I quit taking piano lessons. I thought I was too busy. I was playing sports. The only time I could take piano lessons was at 7 a.m. before school, and that got old really quickly, and so I quit, and I regret it now. In my junior year of high school, I ordered a class ring. I thought I wanted a class ring, even though my parents had offered me cash not to get the class ring, and my two older brothers had told me definitely take the cash. I got the class ring, and I regret it. In the late 1990s, E-Trade made it possible for individual investors to pick their own stocks. So I invested the minimum, which is $2,000 at the time, in my E-Trade account, bought some stocks, and promptly lost 70% of that money over the next couple of years. I regret that. I once passed up a good job that I'd take if I had it to do all over again. Now, those are just a few of the regrets that I'm willing to share with you in public today. There are some more serious and profound regrets, but this isn't the time or the place to rehearse those, and I don't expect you today to rehearse out loud your deepest regrets in life either. But what I do want to happen this morning, I want us to have an honest, challenging, and I hope inspiring conversation about the kinds of lives we want to live, about the kinds of changes that we can start making this morning, today, so that we can live lives that aren't imprisoned by a bunch of regrets. This past month, each week we've tried to take on a myth, a false myth, something that sounds like common sense but actually will bend your life out of shape if you believe it. So here's the myth I want to address today. The myth is that a life full of regret is unavoidable, and so that all we can do is just enjoy the present moment, maximize our own individual happiness, and avoid at all costs any prolonged reflection on what could have been different. Okay, that's the myth. Kind of a cynical, despairing, life is hard. When we get to the end, we'll be filled with regret. Why bother? Okay, that's the myth. So with that in mind, come to our reading today. It comes to us as tender words shared near the end of life by a Christian leader, by a pastor, Paul, who has suffered a great deal in the course of his life. He says to Timothy and to us, "My life has been poured out like a drink offering. The time for my departure is near." Here's a person near the end of his life reflecting with utter clarity and seriousness on his own life. These are the dying words of a troubled apostle. If we can listen to them together, we can begin taking stock of the shape of our own lives, and we can even ask for God's help today to make some changes, to get on a different track, to take a different route into the future, if that's what needs to be done for us today. So Paul looks back over the across his life and he says, "I've been poured out like a drink offering." What does that mean? Well, first of all, it means that he sees his life as an offering. As an offering. He sees his life as a kind of gift which he offers back to God. And it means that that offering has reached its fullness. It's come to the end. It's been fully poured out. So to view your own life as an offering poured out in the worship of God, that requires, if it hasn't happened yet, that requires some sort of deep and profound conversion. A conversion in which you begin to see your life in this sense of an offering. It involves coming to see your life in this new way, that everything is grace, that everything you have is a gift from God, and each day is just a chance to offer it back to God as a returned gift. It means living your life to the full, making the most each day of the strengths and the gifts that you've been giving, finding ways to bless other people simply by being yourself, by acting out your own unique identity as one of God's beloved children, an offering. Okay. But if our lives can be an offering at their best, they can also feel like a long and difficult race. That's the other metaphor used here. The writer describes his life as an intense, long-distance race full of agony, run through to the very end so as to get a reward. So this morning, as we're reflecting on our lives and whether there might be some things that we want to do differently, I want you to find some encouragement and some guidance from these three powerful verbs used in this passage when he says, "I fought the good fight, I finished the race, I kept the faith." Okay? Three great verbs. I fought the good fight. The point is that his life has not been easy. It has required strenuous effort, as if one had been competing in the Olympic Games. That's the illusion. I fought hard. Second verb, I finished the race. It was long. It was long. It felt like a marathon. It required endurance. It required resilience to get back up again and again when things didn't go my way. I finished the race. The race was long. It discourages the faint of heart. There are enough hills and challenges all along the way. There are enough setbacks and surprises to defeat anyone who thought this race was going to be easy. It's not. I finished the race. And I kept the faith. Our lives actually are a race that can be finished and finished well. Paul says, "I valued and I guarded this gift, this treasure, the good news of Jesus Christ, which was handed down to me by those who came before me. I treasured it. I kept the faith." Sometimes when we read Scripture, we assume that these early Christians were somehow very different from us, that they were superstars capable of feats of faith that ordinary people like us could never accomplish. We might assume that someone like Paul, for instance, was so devoted to God, so saintly, so pious, that at the end of his life, there was only serenity, this calm peacefulness as he looked back over his life. Now, keep in mind who we're talking about. Paul spent the first half of his life arresting Christians, overseeing their punishment, sometimes by death. And even at the end of his life, not only is there painful memories of a life lived the wrong way early on, there are also painful memories of betrayal by close friends. Memories of harm suffered at the hands of people who were very close to him. What's remarkable about Paul's confession at the end of life is that these painful memories are not accompanied, somehow, not accompanied by continuing bitterness and dreams for revenge. Instead, they're accompanied by a tender, beautiful prayer for his opponents. See if this works, as you call to mind some of your opponents. May it not be counted against them. May it not be counted against them. They hurt me. They really wounded me. They betrayed me. They weren't there when I needed them. You can say all that. That's all true for all of us. But may it not be counted against them. What a beautiful prayer. At the end of life or at the beginning or in the middle or wherever we can say it. May it not be counted against them. When Paul looks back on his life, he's not fixated on his own wrongdoing, nor is he fixated on complaining to God about all the difficult parts of his life. What he does instead is make this wonderful confession: I was rescued from the lion's mouth. Now, that will that be your testimony at the end of your life? That you were rescued. That you were rescued from something threatening and powerful that could have destroyed you. Were you rescued from loneliness, from greed, from a lack of confidence, from feelings of shame, from anger or hate or grudges or revenge fantasies? Were you rescued from the prison of a cold heart into a life of kindness and compassion towards other people? I don't know what the central threat has been in your life, but I do know that God can and does rescue us from whatever threatens us. And I know that part of living a life not defined by regret involves welcoming this good news that we have been rescued from something powerful, welcoming that news into the center of who we are. Paul was ashamed that he spent the first half of his life harassing followers of Jesus. He was frustrated, and he was honest about it, by the many ways that people betrayed his trust, let him down, undermined his leadership. But those painful realities weren't the deepest framework of his life. So I guess, back to this title, maybe not a life without regrets, but a life where our regrets aren't the primary framework for who we are and how things wind up. The deepest framework for him involves seeing his own life as an offering given back to God and as a race well run. What mattered most to him was that his life taken as a whole was a confession of praise. That's why he can say, "To God be the glory forever and ever. Amen." This is the final life, final line of a life lived faithfully. This is the desire that keeps burning all the way through, all the way to the end of life. It's like our lives as a great hymn sung full throttle to the final note. May God be glorified in my life, and may God be glorified in all things. In 1938, Harvard University started tracking two different groups of people in the Boston area. They were tracking a group of students at the university, which were all men at the time, and they were tracking a group of poor inner city children as well. So 1938. That program has had four different directors over the course of its now more than 80-year lifespan. It is now the longest-running survey on happiness, joy, and meaning in life. So in other words, the people they first started interviewing them, they've continued interviewing those people every year throughout this whole time. So do you know what makes people happy and what makes life meaningful according to this 80-year-long happiness study? If you ask young people what they think will make them happy, they usually say something about a rewarding career or a decent paying job, or respect or status, or even good health, avoiding pain. That's not true. And it's not really about avoiding mistakes or regrets either, in light of what we're talking about today. What this study has found again and again is that it's always about relationships. Warm, affectionate, trusting relationships are what keep us not only happy, but healthy. So the current director of this happiness project summarized some of their findings in a recent TED Talk. So let me just mention three that he points out. 80 years of asking people what makes their lives worth living. First, social connections are good for us, and loneliness kills. It's all about connections to other people. Secondly, it's not the number of friends or the number of committed relationships you have. It's the quality of those connections that really matters. In other words, if you're connected to other people, but those connections are low quality relationships, that is, they're full of conflict and they lack the warmth that sustains us, those connections won't work, right? It's the quality, warmth, affectionate, trusting relationships. Third, these good relationships in life protect not just our bodies and have physical health results. They protect our brains as well. People in warm, trusting, affectionate relationships not only live longer, their mental health and their memories stay sharper later into life as well. He ended that TED Talk by saying this: high-quality relationships are what keep us happy and healthy, and yet clearly this is not a quick fix thing. You can't run out and fix this today. Relationships are messy. They span your whole life. They involve lots of conflict sometimes. They take lots of work and energy. Working at our relationships will be a lifelong process that we never finish. But is it really any surprise that the God who comes to us in Jesus Christ has created us to find our deepest joy in caring, trusting relationships with other people? Is it any surprise to us, as people of the good news, that this is what matters over the course of a long life? In 2009, the artist Candy Chang created a space on a public wall in New Orleans. And the artwork was just, she wrote a phrase. It said, "Before I die," and then she left a long blank to see what would happen. So within days, the wall was completely filled by other people. People wrote things like, "Before I die, I want to straddle the international dateline." Wouldn't have been mine, but okay. "Before I die, I want to sing for millions. Before I die, I want to be completely myself. Before I die, I would like to have a relationship with my sister. Be a great dad. Go skydiving. Make a difference in someone's life." Thousands and thousands of versions of "before I die, blank." So today, you and I can begin to write something new in that space for ourselves. Can't control what's already happened, but looking forward, what do we want to happen? To be alive as a human being with limited reserves of energy, limited abilities, limited resources, all that requires that we make 1,000 decisions on the fly, take 1,000 risks, even when we're never sure how things are going to wind up. So surely we come to regret some of those decisions that we've made. That's obvious. We'll come to regret some of the positions we held, attitudes we harbored, relationships we betrayed, opportunities we missed. These past mistakes, blunders, wrong turns, betrayals, and omissions, none of us can avoid them. They're part of life. And yet, God's love leads us forward into a new kind of life that doesn't have to be just more of the same. God's forgiveness and God's healing allow us to begin to see ourselves, in spite of some of those regrets, begin to see ourselves more playfully. We can begin to laugh at ourselves, because our lives are not some kind of resume where we have to hide with shame the things that we regret. Our lives can become an act of praise, an offering to God of our best efforts to love and care for one another, and of our failures to do so, all as part of this great confession: to God be glory forever and ever.